From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. This week in New York, representatives from 191 nations gathered for the 59th meeting of the United Nations General Assembly. It is tradition for the American president to welcome the General Assembly, and President Bush did just that, defending his decision to go to war in Iraq for about 24 minutes. The reception was described as polite, despite the president's strained, at best, relationship with the United Nations. His remarks come less than a week after UN Secretary General Kofi Annan said the U.S.-led invasion was illegal. Martin Walker is editor-in-chief of United Press International. He's tracked global response to the president's speech. Martin, welcome back.
Hello there. Nice to be back on the air with you.
Now, in the American press, we had David Fromkin from the Washington Post, who wrote that the speech could be described as misguided, simplistic, imperious, and trigger-happy, or it could be described as strong, resolute, unyielding, and unapologetic, depending on your point of view and your view of the president and the war in Iraq. Do you see a contrast there between the American coverage and that in Europe and the Middle East?
Absolutely. Almost all of the American newspapers, even ones that were critical, focused upon President Bush, upon what he'd said, upon his insistence that this was not a time to retreat but to prevail, that he would stand by Iraq and Afghanistan all the way through the elections, and that his overall grand strategy to try and bring democracy to the Arab world was still his guiding star. The rest of the world took an entirely different approach. Whether you looked at the Financial Times in Britain, the Times in Britain, you looked at Le Monde or Figaro in France, you looked at Süddeutsche Zeitung in Germany, if you looked at the Middle Eastern press, what you got was not just Bush alone, but a duel between Kofi Annan, the UN Secretary General, and President Bush. The way it was put in Le Monde was deux visions du monde s'affrontent devant l'ONU, two visions of the world confront each other before the United Nations. The Financial Times, Bush and Annan are going head to head. Italy's La Repubblica said that we're experiencing a new ice age in international relations, with the United States on the one side and the rest of the international community on the other. From Egypt, Al-Jumhuriya, which is an ally of America, here is a fascinating call: Annan's confirmation that war in Iraq was illegitimate and unlawful amount to a clear signal for the international community to do its best to support the courageous Iraqi resistance.
Wow.
That's strong stuff.
Well, what about the big conservative papers, those who have stood pretty staunchly with Bush throughout the war?
Well, it's a bit of a problem. Le Figaro, for example, which really has supported the war, was very critical that Bush's speech at the UN excited a great deal of skepticism among the diplomats who heard him, and equal skepticism among journalists who did not recognize in his vision of an Iraq moving towards democratic elections anything like the reality that they and their colleagues confront every day in the chaos of Iraq.
Well, speaking about reality, just hours after Bush's speech, Democratic presidential candidate John Kerry held a press conference, and essentially he charged the president with being in denial. He said, and I quote, "Iraq is in crisis and the president needs to live in a world of reality, not in a world of fantasy spin." Was that a theme?
It was indeed, and particularly in the Arab press. Jordan's got a new daily newspaper, Al Had, which said that Bush's speech about the elections is a political joke that isn't funny. There was also a similar kind of comment. This was in the London-based Al-Quds Al-Arabi, commenting upon Ilawi's interviews and speeches in which the Iraqi prime minister has said that the situation is not as bad as it's painted. Al-Quds says, Ilawi strolls in the corridors of the United Nations as if he has the legitimacy of representing Iraq in this international lodge. But the reality on the ground of Iraq shows that Ilawi represents only a small area in Baghdad called the Green Zone. Not a day passes without operations against the American forces and the Iraqi police stations. I have to say that my own reporters in Iraq, both Western reporters and Arabic reporters, are reporting, and they are reflecting a very much more contentious and divisive and violent reality than the one that Bush and Ilawi have been suggested.
It strikes me that it wouldn't help Kerry much in this country if it were widely known that the Middle Eastern papers stand four square with him.
Well, that's absolutely right. The Guardian, which is my old newspaper in Britain, cited an opinion poll survey by the pollsters HI Europe early this month, which found that if Europeans had a vote, they'd back Kerry over Bush by a 6-1 margin. Bush would get just 6% in Germany, 5% in Spain, and 4% in France. And the Guardian went on, you would think those numbers might hurt Bush, making clear how unpopular he is in the world. But they don't. If anything, they hurt Kerry, suggesting that he is the candidate of limp-wristed foreigners and therefore somehow less American. We may find that a sorry state of affairs, but there's little we can do about it. In the democratic contest that matters most to the world is disenfranchised.
Okay. Martin, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Martin Walker is editor-in-chief of United Press International. As the war on terror rolls on, so do the complaints about excessive government secrecy. This summer, 9/11 Commission Chairman Tom Kaine observed that 3/4 of the classified material he reviewed during the investigation should not have been classified in the first place. Since then, we've heard a new round of calls for revising federal guidelines on secrecy, and not just from the usual run of whining liberals. Conservatives are whining, too. Among them, Senator Trent Lott, who last month co-authored an op-ed in the New York Times blaming excessive government secrecy on political motivations by classifiers. And the same day, none other than Donald Rumsfeld suggested that, quote, the hemorrhaging of classified information might have something to do with there being too much classified information in the first place. Mark Tapscott, a staff member at the conservative Washington think tank, the Heritage Foundation, has long decried the government's squeeze on public information. Mark, welcome back to OTM.
Thank you. It's very good to be here.
So, Mark, what makes secrecy a particularly conservative issue?
Because with big government, which of course is the bane of all conservatives, you get big secrecy. And as a result, conservatives become very concerned anytime documents or other information that the taxpayers paid for are denied them and they are not allowed to see them.
I've been reading a lot of what you've been writing lately, and you've noted a couple of really egregious examples of government secrecy. Can you give us one?
Absolutely. The federal government has a system, a computer software program, that is called the Past Performance Information Retrieval System. It maintains information on the performance by more than 300,000 federal contractors on how they have performed on their contracts. This is exactly the kind of information that the taxpayers ought to have full access to, and yet they have no access to it. It's entirely kept from the public examination.
Every time you write about secrecy, you always say this is a problem of bloated federal bureaucracy. You don't lay blame at the feet of the Bush administration. But wouldn't you submit that the problem has gotten a lot worse in the past 3.5 years?
It ebbs and flows. There were a record number of FOI requests last year, more than 3 million of them, according to the Department of Justice. And 99.999% of those requests were all handled by career federal employees. The career people who make most of the decisions about FOI rarely, if ever, even see a political appointee, much less receive direction from them. So I think the problem is that there is a culture of secrecy that is frankly impervious in many respects to the direction of political appointees one way or the other. Regardless of who's in power, when you have big government, you will have people in government abusing the power and using it to conceal information that they believe the public shouldn't have.
But Mark, if it ebbs and flows, then the last couple of years have seen one heck of a flow. In fiscal years 2001 to 2003, the average number of decisions to classify information increased 50% over the previous 5 fiscal years. Classification actions in 2003 were more than double those recorded, say, 10 years earlier. It's been an extraordinary explosion of secrecy that could hardly be described as in the general run of ebb and flow.
Some portion of that flow in the last 3 years is legitimately understood to be as a product of the war on terror. There are things that we don't want Osama bin Laden to know, and that requires some classification. And my point has always been that when you have big government and also a national security situation, we shouldn't be surprised that officials will always err on the side of caution and overclassify. That doesn't make it right, but it does explain that it does happen.
Wouldn't you say, then, that the excuse of national security is used to overclassify information in a way that doesn't protect our national security?
Absolutely, and I would go beyond that to say that it is typical of people on the right, quite frankly, that when national security is invoked, that becomes a virtually an automatic pass to go ahead and classify it. But you have the same phenomena among people on the left on non-national security matters.
But obviously, it's not the Democrats that have prevented us from seeing records pertaining to Cheney's Energy Task Force, for instance, or withheld the cost estimates of the Medicare prescription drug legislation from Congress. These are White House initiatives, and they have nothing to do with national security, right?
Isn't it interesting that the Cheney Commission on the Energy Task Force invoked in the same manner an alleged right to maintain secrecy about who they talked with that was invoked by the Clinton Healthcare Task Force? My point is they were both wrong, and I wrote specifically about the Bush administration being on the wrong side of that particular issue.
What is your reaction to the legislation sponsored by Senators Trent Lott and Ron Wyden that would create an independent national security classification board? Do you think it would create more bureaucracy, or do you think it would address the concerns we've talked about today?
The problem is that it doesn't go far enough to recognize the fundamental problem. The fundamental problem is big government creates big secrecy. Therefore, the solution is less government. In the interim, given that we are going to have big government for some period into the future, measures like Wyden-Lott, I think, are prudent. The key thing is how they are administered, and I would hope, for example, that legislation would stipulate people from outside the government as members of that board.
How far in the future do you think we'll have big government?
Hey, couldn't resist, could you? Let us hope, in the interest of individual freedom, that big government is no longer a problem for any of us sooner rather than later.
Mark Tapscott, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mark Tapscott is the director of the Center for Media and Public Policy at the Conservative Heritage Foundation.
Coming up, determining the threat level for freedom of information and a reason to think well of personal injury lawyers.
This is On the Media from NPR. This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. The war on terrorism brings with it an ever-present state of alert and constant warnings about the threat to our society. Most of those warnings are from our government in the form of color-coded threat levels. But now comes an alert about our government's incremental assault on the public's right to know. This comes courtesy of the Reporters Committee for Freedom of the Press in a report complete with a color-coded chart of its very own. Lucy Dalglish is Executive Director of the Reporters Committee, and she joins me now. Lucy, welcome back to the show.
Thank you.
We are usually loath to bite on naked publicity stunts, but this one is kind of clever.
Thank you.
Some of the alert levels are relatively low. Access to printer's ink, code beige. But two areas of press freedom that you believe are in the red zone, red or severe,
yes,
are access to terrorism and immigration legal proceedings and the
Correct.
Freedom of Information Act. Tell me.
There has been a cloak of secrecy that has slipped down over our court system that I find to be very, very disturbing. Immediately after 9/11, more than 1,200 foreign nationals were arrested, and we don't know who those people are. We don't know who's down in Guantanamo. There have been a number of entirely secret criminal court cases in the federal courts. I'm perfectly willing to concede that some of these folks probably do need to be handled with extreme care. However, one thing that we've always assumed, I think, in this country is that we don't lock people up in secret and essentially throw away the key.
For many years, the press and the public have had access to executive branch documents through the Freedom of Information Act. You say that's under attack at the moment. Tell me how.
Well, shortly after 9/11, Attorney General Ashcroft issued a directive advising the executive branch agencies how they should interpret the Federal Freedom of Information Act. And his interpretation of the act was far more restrictive of the release of documents than the previous order under Attorney General Reno had been. And the result of that is that fewer documents are being released to the public. There are also actions that are happening in the executive branch agencies that make it very difficult for information about critical infrastructure such as communications or transportation to be released to the public. Websites that agencies used to have posted on the internet have been taken down. There is just a general atmosphere of secrecy out there.
Well, let's go back to your color-coded alert chart, which is not only alarming, but very pretty, if I might say.
Oh, thank you. I wish we had a little bit more green in there. We don't have anybody in the green territory.
I'm sorry to hear that on aesthetic and philosophical grounds. But tell me about where stands the Patriot Act. It is, of course, much reviled, but also often defended by the administration is absolutely necessary to protect the homeland at a time of imminent threat. What color does it get, and why is there less urgency attached to it than some of these other categories?
Well, you know, when people say that access to information is going the wrong way, they just assume that it has something to do with the Patriot Act. And the Patriot Act does not cover nearly as much as people seem to think it does. We declare that the Patriot Act is orange, high risk. There are some major problems with it. The one that distresses us in the media the most is the fact that contrary to the Privacy Protection Act of 1980, which makes it extremely difficult for the Justice Department or any police to search a newsroom, the Patriot Act makes it much more likely that the FBI is going to search newsrooms to find out who people's sources were and information that had been turned over to reporters. And really, the part that makes it just about unconscionable from a journalist standpoint is if your newsroom has been searched, the Patriot Act gags you from telling anyone that you've been searched.
All right, I'm thoroughly depressed. I don't know if any buildings are going to blow up immediately around me, but I can certainly see that other threats are very real. And yet, in your introduction of this report, you write that American citizens and lawmakers seem to be slowly realizing that they must speak up or their ideal of a free and open society will be a thing of the past. What evidence is there that the American public is really waking up to these attacks on press freedom?
You're getting more individuals and organizations filing lawsuits. I'm noticing more letters to the editor on these topics. I think the media has finally started to wake up and is starting to cover this issue. I mean, we've been putting out this report for 3 years now. This is the first time I've gotten a sizable number of media organizations who want to talk about the report, but the information has been there for 3 years.
Okay, Lucy. Well, as always, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Lucy Dalglish is executive director of the Reporters Committee for Freedom of the Press, which has just released a very alarming color-coded system for determining how threatened our public information is. In the midst of unprecedented deficit spending, the Bush campaign has been unable to attack John Kerry as a free-spending Democrat. But the Republican candidates are frequently playing another golden oldie.
We need to stop junk lawsuits if we want to keep this economy growing.
We will reform medical liability so the system serves patients and good doctors, not personal injury lawyers.
See, I don't think you can be pro-doctor and pro-patient and pro-hospital and pro-trial lawyer at the same time.
The crusade against trial lawyers has its champions on the Hill, too. Last week, the House of Representatives approved a measure that would penalize attorneys who filed, quote, frivolous lawsuits. Whether tort reform is a good social and economic policy is a legitimate political issue, but it is also a serious journalistic issue. Investigative reporter Morton Mintz, who broke the thalidomide story during his many decades at the Washington Post, says court records from civil litigation are critical to shedding light on major problems otherwise hidden from public view. He joins me now. Morton, welcome to On the Media.
Thank you.
Well, before we get to the journalistic issue, tell me what it is about tort reform that makes it such a mainstay of Republican platforms going back almost as long as I can remember.
I think it's a very simple question. It's because they get their money from industries that benefit. They get huge amounts of money from the insurance industry, from manufacturers, many of them who have improperly concealed dangers to the public and don't want to be sued.
Over the years, you have spent a good number of hours, probably cumulatively months, poring over court records. Would you ever have been able to do the work that you've done absent product liability litigation and the like?
Absolutely not. I'll give one example. In the case of one tobacco case I covered in 1988, this was a case called Cipollone in Newark, New Jersey. The only way that we could get to see what the tobacco companies knew and when they knew it was to be in the courtroom when these documents were put into evidence, depositions, and so forth. And without trial lawyers, whatever abuses some of them commit, how would these documents have come out? They are a check and balance on corporate power, an opportunity for the public to learn via the press, when the press does its job, of the abuses that corporations so often perpetrate.
You did some important reporting, I guess it was in the early 70s, about the Dalkon Shield intrauterine device. Tell me about that, please.
The Dalkon Shield was used by millions of women. The company knew that it was not as effective as they claimed, and they had evidence it was not safe. Tens of thousands of women suffered pelvic infections. A great many became sterilized. Many died. The story came out in litigation.
The Dalkon Shield is not the only example you can invoke here. There's the Ford Pinto, the exploding gas tank, the flammable pajamas. And tell me about the Bic lighter.
The Bic lighter would explode in people's hands and cause fires. It turns out that Bic was aware of 55 cases from 1980 through 1983 where fires had started in left front shirt pockets alone. The company knew this, but didn't disclose it until lawsuits were filed. And that essentially is the story in so many of these things. You either get the information from court documents or you get them from congressional hearings. And as far as congressional hearings are concerned, over a period of 30 years, approximately, I covered oversight hearings of the FDA performance. A bad drug got on the market, killed people unnecessarily, was ineffective. Congressmen would hold a hearing. And when the press covered those hearings, the public learned about this. The moment, this is fact, not political opinion, the moment the Republicans took control of the House in January of 1995, that kind of oversight came to a dead halt.
It seems to me that you have been enormously prolific over a very long period of time, decades, in calling these issues to the attention of the readers of the Washington Post. But I'm going to take a wild guess and speculate that it wasn't always an easy task for you to get the space and the display in the Post. How hard is it to get people's attention for a problem that doesn't begin with, you know, at least an explosion?
Well, I can't speak about the Post today. I left in 1988. The Post did give me substantial support. A lot of these things take huge amounts of time. And if the paper isn't willing to spend money and support you, then you're in trouble. It was often difficult. But I think really it should have been difficult because the kind of reporting that I did had, as our lawyers correctly saw it, a huge potential for libel actions.
Can you ever even get them in the paper if you didn't have the sheaf of court documents to back up the central assertion of the plaintiffs?
No, if you don't have hard evidence that a company or a person has done something wrong, you should not be able to get in the paper with it. Corporations are entitled to fairness, too. The whole thing depends upon basically knowing what you're talking about. And court documents generated by product liability lawsuits provide that opportunity.
Morton, thank you very much.
You're welcome. Glad to be here.
Morton Mintz, former Washington Post reporter, is an author and advocate against tort reform.
Well, I am now.
Len Gabe is a lawyer based in Austin, Texas, whose clients include many people injured or worse in car wrecks or through medical malpractice. Gabe often does best by his clients by keeping them out of court. He'll put together what's called a settlement film, a kind of documentary of the plaintiff's misfortune, and show it to the defendant. 9 times out of 10, they settle, and everyone is spared the ordeal of a trial. Gabe approaches these films both as lawyer and director.
What we try and do is approach it from a standpoint of this is what has happened to these people, and they are not just a claim number that an insurance carrier might have on their desk in a folder. This is their story. You have an opportunity to get the case settled if you wish. If not, you've just seen some of what will be presented at trial in the case.
So basically what you're talking about is an audio-video form of arm twisting.
Yeah.
What's the reaction in the room generally when you show them?
Very interesting. And I'll give you a good example. There was a video that we presented in a very serious case. The defense lawyer is known to be a kind of a hothead, you know, steam coming out of his ears and fire out of his eyes and all of that sort of thing. And the effect that it had on him, he didn't know what to say when it was his turn to talk. And it mellowed him out quite a bit.
And he settled?
The case did settle. I would say 9 out of 10 times they settle.
And what role do you play in the making of these films?
Well, it started off that I was producer, director, writer, editor. I set up the lights and operated the camera and did the interviews. In 2000, I took a film class here in Austin, and I now work with David Layton, who's one of the assistants at the film school.
But mostly they're made by filmmakers for lawyers, right? I mean, you're unusual in being a lawyer who makes the movies yourself.
I don't know any other lawyers that do these themselves. And there's a real advantage to having a lawyer who handles these cases on a daily basis making your video, and rather than someone who might be proficient, you know, aesthetically with a camera, because they might not know all the elements that make a good case.
Tell me about the Firestone Tires case.
This was probably the most tragic case that I've ever worked on. A family of three was coming back from a vacation when their Ford Explorer with a Firestone tire, the tire exploded. They went into the median, and the mother survived. The father and the six-year-old girl did not.
There's a part in the film where you reconstruct the crash scene.
We had the 911 tape, and we found the young lady who called in to 911 and EMS, and through that 911 tape and photos that we had from the scene from DPS, we were able to really paint the picture of what was going on at the scene.
Is the child okay?
And there's a lady inside the car.
Okay, okay, calm down.
Please.
Calm down. Is the child all right?
Is the child okay?
The child is okay. The child is okay?
I call it the Grand Slam of Grand Slams. Anyone who watches that part of the video is there at the scene experiencing what this woman was experiencing at the time. Very, very effective and very sad.
Your most tragic case, and yet your most successful film. The defense settled for a lot more than you expected.
I think the defense settled for a lot more than they expected. And then the family required that as part of the settlement, the board of Ford Motor Company sit and watch the video so that they would know what the problems that they were having at Ford and Bridgestone did to a very real family.
Is there a larger issue here? We just heard from investigative reporter Morton Mintz, who says that these trials are necessary so the public can be informed of the misfortunes of clients like yours, and it could protect a lot more people in the long run if these cases actually went to trial.
Oftentimes, confidentiality agreements may be to the amount of the settlement, but a lot of the information that is developed throughout the course of litigation and getting a case prepared to go to trial is not subject to a confidentiality agreement. And much of that information is available through associations like the American Trial Lawyers Association, through the Texas Trial Lawyers Association and other trial lawyers associations around the country. There are listservs. There are companies that report verdicts and settlements. A lot of times what will happen is a lawyer will get a fantastic settlement and will report that information, make it public, and it's in a database that just has to be accessed.
So what you're saying is that the information is out there, reporters may just have to dig a little deeper. But what happens if, in order to get a good settlement for your client, you have to agree to the squelching of documents? The defendant demands it.
I've not been in that situation. I think that, you know, the people that may be in a situation like that may be with, you know, medical devices, products liability, but in the regular car wreck cases or, you know, even medical malpractice cases, those are issues that may not be, you know, squelchable.
Len, thank you very much.
Okay, Brooke, thank you.
Lawyer/filmmaker Len Gabay practices in Austin, Texas.
Coming up, the Brazilian government wants to license reporters, and for those who love to hate the media, Rathergate is the gift that keeps on giving.
This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for NPR comes from this and other NPR member stations and the Kresge Foundation, building the capacity of nonprofit organizations through challenge grants since 1924, on the web at kresge.org. The Kellogg Foundation, helping people help themselves by investing in individuals, their families, and their communities, on the web at www.wkkf.org. And the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, making grants to improve the health and healthcare of all Americans, on the web at rwjf.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. OTM listeners might remember a recent diplomatic flap involving the New York Times correspondent in Brazil. The reporter, Larry Roter, had written an article suggesting that President Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva had something of a drinking problem. The union-backed Brazilian government responded by expelling Roter, an order that was eventually rescinded under heavy criticism from at home and abroad.
Now Lula is again under fire. At issue is a proposal, currently pending in Brazil's Congress, for a national journalism council with the power to, quote, orient, discipline, and monitor reporters. It would apply to foreign correspondents like Roter as well as to domestic reporters, who could theoretically be barred from the profession if they violated its new code of ethics. In a recent piece, Roter himself noted that Lula's proposal had prompted harsh criticism from journalists, human rights groups, and legal experts. But that assertion, it turns out, was only half correct. The plan has been denounced, but it did not originate with President Lula. Journalist Antonio Brazil is on sabbatical from his job teaching journalism in Rio de Janeiro, and he joins us in our studio. Welcome back to the show.
Oh, thank you. Nice to be here.
So if Lula didn't hatch this plan for a journalism council, who did?
This is a proposal that comes from the Federation of Brazilian Journalists, the National Federation of Journalists.
It's hard for me to understand a move like this. Enlisting the government's participation is anything but self-defeating for journalists. What was the union thinking?
First of all, you have to remember that Brazil now has a left-wing government with a former union leader as president. They have a special relationship, unions and the government. Lula and the government officials were very clear in terms that this press council would be a professional body, similar to those that regulate other activities, you know, like doctors, engineers, and lawyers, and would be free from political control. But no one is that naive to think that a very powerful press council like this would not have strong links or be under the influence of government.
So this body, with what will almost certainly be very strong links to the Lula government, its decisions will have the force of law, no?
Yes, they would, including the idea of who can be a journalist. You need to have a degree. You would have to have a card from the council. You have to pay taxes, you know, some kind of a levy to the council, which is another thing that most Brazilian journalists were not very keen on.
Isn't that just inviting an increasingly autocratic regime to stifle expression?
It could be. I think it's a possibility. But on the other hand, you have to remember that in Brazil, like in most places in Latin America, including Venezuela, very powerful families control the media. Those families have a tradition of being against unions, against regulation in terms of rights, in terms of benefits. So you see, it's much more complicated than saying that a journalist cannot have a special relationship with government.
It strikes me that what is at stake here is nothing less than a fundamental of democracy, which is that the press, however responsible or irresponsible, should be left alone to do what it does without being vetted along the way by any kind of government body.
But again, it's one thing for you to have this idea of an independent press with a lot of competition in America. The New York Times competes with the Washington Post and the LA Times and CBS against NBC. But if you see in Latin America, there is no real competition. The power that comes from media barons, it's sometimes even more powerful than governments. You know, we have examples in Brazil. You know, the very first election after military rule, you know, Fernando Collor de Mello, he was elected because he had the support of a very strong media corporation. And that was a key factor for his election. No wonder the government is very sensitive about this free press, free independent journalists that work for the big media. And people are starting to realize that when we talk about freedom of the press in Brazil, maybe it's freedom for some big corporation to say whatever they want and not necessarily a very representative or democratic press.
Perhaps the media barons are disproportionately powerful at this moment in Brazilian history. But as Larry Roeder points out in his story, this proposal for a regulatory body comes at a time when the press has been rooting out corruption at the very core of the Lula administration. Shouldn't we be suspicious that this proposal would come up at a time when the Lula administration has been repeatedly embarrassed by this kind of story?
Bob, you've got the main criticism to this whole story. It's the timing. Why now? You have to see this as an experiment. The previous governments were either a military dictatorship or neoliberal governments, one that free markets, free for all, and journalists had to survive. And the Lula government, you know, this new trend in Brazilian politics, they are under very heavy pressure to show that they are not the same government as before. But there is so much pressure for you to do something that you don't realize that, okay, you have to do something, but you don't have to do something now.
All right. Well, Antonio, once again, thanks very much.
You're welcome.
Antonio Brazil works as a journalist in Rio de Janeiro. He's currently a visiting scholar teaching journalism at Rutgers University. A number of listeners last week were displeased with our take on the CBS memo scandal. Several of you echoed the sentiments of Sundar Srinivasan, who describes himself as a disappointed listener in Chelsea, New York. He writes, "I'm no stranger to misplacing priorities or myopia, but I suspect even Mr. Magoo would have done a better job prioritizing your coverage of Reservegate versus Rathergate. Did a 10-year-old story about the president get unfairly obscured? Probably. But the CBS imbroglio is the biggest document authenticity story since the Hitler diaries, and it is breaking weeks ahead of what is expected to be one of the closest presidential elections in years. Why cover the molehill when there's a mountain of meta-journalism issues right next to it?"
It's true. We saw Rathergate as just one more media felony in a season marked by crimes both of commission, as in the lies spouted by certain cable talk show hosts, and of omission by news outlets who failed to fact-check falsehoods flung from the stump. But clearly, this story is not just one of many. It's a focal point for rage against the liberal media machine. We heard it even in the background of another story. On Wednesday, a bystander near CNN cameras at a campaign event let it rip for over an hour.
Those four moderators who will be running the program.
We struggled to hear.
They have got to speak to whether or not they're going to sign this.
And on the 15th iteration, we finally made it out. Stop Dan Rather Now.
Running ahead among women for the longest time this year, but in the last month.
Of course, Rather stopped denying what had become increasingly obvious and conceded that not just the network, but he himself had blown it.
Also, I want to say personally and directly, I'm sorry.
I'm sure he is in absolute agony over this.
Bob Woodward, whose illustrious career at the Washington Post is based on the artful reporting of leaks, spoke of Rather's plight this week on The Larry King Show.
It's very humbling, and you try to put up safeguards, you try to have multiple sources. Going back to Watergate, Carl Bernstein and I got some things wrong. We had kind of a two-source rule. And that saved us in the end. That was the safety net on this. CBS did not have a safety net.
This week, more calls for Rather's head, more musings on the future of CBS. The fact that a CBS producer phoned an operative from the Kerry campaign advising him to speak to Rather's source struck many, including us, as deeply inappropriate. And of course, all week there was more speculation as to the creator of the dubious document that CBS rushed to broadcast, CNN's Wolf Blitzer.
Some people already have suspicions about who's really behind the scandal. Yesterday on this program, the Democratic National Committee chairman, Terry McAuliffe, pointed a direct finger at a longtime Republican strategist.
I mean, the New York Post today reports that Roger Stone, an old dirty trickster from the Nixon days, may have been involved in the production of these documents. We were not involved in any shape, way, or form.
Roger Stone is here now to talk about that.
Stone offered no comment to the New York Post, but he had plenty to say to Blitzer about the charge.
Categorically false. If Mr. McAuliffe has any evidence whatsoever that I have any involvement, or anyone else in the Republican Party has any involvement with these documents, let him put up or shut up.
Meanwhile, CBS has chosen two notables to investigate the scandal, retired AP chief Lou Bacardi and Republican Dick Thornburg, who ran the Justice Department under Presidents Reagan and Bush Sr. As the scandal plays out, some media critics worry that the fallout will have a chilling effect on the press, make it even less likely to tell the truth to power. A few point to a double standard, noting that CBS is slammed, while those same critics demand no mea culpas from Robert Novak, who made use of an illegal White House leak to reveal the name of a CIA operative. The fact is, leaks are the fuel that powers much of journalism, the best and the worst of it. And there's been a steady stream of them from and about the Bush administration. Bob examined the phenomenon back in 2001, and we thought it was worth another play.
In the immediate aftermath of September 11th's carnage, Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld faced the press to deliver an important message. Not to America, not to the international community, not to the media, but to his own Defense Department. It was a warning about leaking classified information because a leaker, Rumsfeld declared, is a threat.
It's a person who's willing to violate federal criminal statutes and willing to frustrate our efforts to track down and deal with terrorists, and willing to reveal information that could cause the lives of men and women in uniform.
2 weeks later, USA Today ran a page one story detailing U.S. Special Forces operations already proceeding on the ground in Afghanistan. 2 weeks after that, President Bush was so infuriated at leaks from Capitol Hill that he tried to cut off classified briefings to all but a few members of Congress.
Some members did not accept that responsibility. Somebody didn't. So I took it upon myself to notify the leadership of the Congress that I intend to protect our troops.
In the end, the president had to back off because by law, the administration must keep Congress fully informed on intelligence matters. To many inside the Beltway, though, it was the president who seemed to be out of the loop. In Washington, leaking is not only business as usual, it's a way of life.
What the president was saying is, I can't believe that people are getting classified briefings and then leaking information. Come on, Mr. President, it's what happens every day.
Scott Armstrong is an investigative reporter, author, and founder of the National Security Archive, a repository of declassified information. He says leakers are not only ubiquitous, but necessary to journalism and democracy.
They're correcting things. Sometimes they're verifying things. This is how we get our information. It's an information economy.
And in the information economy, there is never a recession because there are too many journalists chasing too many bureaucrats and politicians with too many reasons to blab. One who reputedly did not blab was Leon Firth, the vice president's national security advisor in the Clinton administration, and someone known for being maddeningly leak-proof. Firth says that was a matter of integrity and discipline. Discipline, however, diminishes geometrically with each additional individual entrusted with a given piece of information.
You have a small meeting. Everybody in that meeting is extremely responsible, and nobody likes leaks of sensitive information. But they all go back from that meeting to their buildings, and they feel obliged to brief at least one or two other people who are very close to them and important to them operationally. And those people, in turn, brief one or two people who are important to them operationally, and pretty soon you have traversed 6 degrees of separation, and the information has crossed the barrier and is in the public domain.
Beyond carelessness, a main category of leaks comes from disaffected insiders, bureaucrats or political appointees wishing to influence debate or expose blunders within their own agencies. And then there's a third variety, the vanity leak.
And that is that somebody has this information and just can't keep quiet about it and wants to talk about it as a way of basically showing off.
Reporters need to understand those various motivations in order to evaluate the substance of a given leak, but mainly they're concerned with the steady flow of reliable information. Bill Gertz is on the national security beat at the Washington Times. So successful has he been in reporting classified information that he was said to be the main target of the so-called official secrets legislation introduced in, but so far unenacted by, Congress.
You know, as we say in the news business, you're only as good as your sources. So we focus quite a bit on being able to circumvent the official public affairs bureaucracy.
If that sounds like a perverse game, that's because it's a perverse game, whose perversity is rooted in the fact that official spokesmen mouth the carefully parsed pronouncements of politicians who are worried about political consequences and therefore cannot be relied upon on any subject, including the weather. Even Leon Firth, the Clinton White House's Mr. Tightlips, acknowledges the credibility gap.
Dating back to Vietnam and Watergate, the press has had its reasons to be cynical about the motivations of government in wanting to keep information secret.
Even now, in the enlightened and transparent 21st century, the executive branch tends toward willy-nilly classification of innocuous information that properly belongs in the public domain. And when confronted by media organizations with leaked information for confirmation or comment, official Washington often reacts with reflexive cries of national security. This often leaves media organizations with difficult choices. When asked to kill or alter a story, they have to decide, is it really a matter of protecting military or intelligence personnel in the field? Or is the government just trying to shield itself from embarrassment or political fallout? And if the story is held, will it show up the next day in the competition, maybe with a spin favorable to the government? The Washington Times' Bill Gertz.
I can remember in one case we had a story about a CIA officer who was having an affair with an Eastern European intelligence officer, and the CIA had asked that we not publish it, and we didn't. And within a week, the story came out in another news publication.
Some leaks, of course, are well tolerated by administrations because the administration itself, for political or diplomatic reasons, has engineered the leak. Journalist Scott Armstrong.
If you can control the information and you leak it out selectively, you can control the press and you can control the public debate. That's the idea.
Leon Firth.
And I recognize the press has got a problem because there's an infinite requirement for information and for visual images. But the country has a need. Now, is it the government's problem to solve this, or is it the press's problem to figure out how to deal with it?
It's a conundrum, all right. But one answer might be to look elsewhere in the world, where nobody dare leak, and nobody dare publish, and nobody knows what obscenity the regime is up to next. The citizens' protection is the responsibility of any government. Protection from the national government by a vigilant press and its confederates is a unique blessing of democracy. That's it for this week's show. On the Media was directed by Katya Rogers and produced by Megan Ryan, Tony Field, and Mike Wallow, and edited by Brooke. Dylan Keefe is our technical director and Jennifer Munson, our engineer. We had help from Ann Kosseff. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Arun Roth is our senior producer and Dean Capello our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. This is On the Media from NPR. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the William T. Grant Foundation, helping the nation value young people as a resource through research and programs. Online at wtgrantfoundation.org. The Charles Stewart Mott Foundation, online at mott.org, supporting efforts to promote a just, equitable, and sustainable society. And the National Endowment for the Arts. Support from the media comes from the Bydell Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the John and Anna Maria Phillips Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.